What's up, guys? It's your girl Ginger, the true crime queen. I'm reminding you now that listener discretion is advised. The dark nature of the show is not suitable for young ears or those that are sensitive to graphic material. But without further ado, let's get it. Heyo! Happy fall, you guys. Today's case, I think, is pretty well known by the people in the state of Oregon, but I definitely have not seen it listed in many other places. So hopefully this is going to be a new case for a lot of listeners today. This is actually a specially requested case by Amelia D., who joined the Patreon recently. Amelia, I really appreciate your support and the case suggestion. And this one is close to home, too. I actually remember when Kaylee Sawyer's missing posters were going around on Facebook, because her city is not too far from mine. And during the early stages of the case, it was actually feasible that Kaylee could have made it across state lines and even to my area. Today you're going to learn about the very unnecessary kidnapping turned murder of Kaylee Sawyer. But it doesn't just stop there. At least 5 more people get dragged into this crazy string of events across the 2 different states of Oregon and California, which actually turns it into a federal case as well. There will be a trigger warning at the time of the murder and heads up for a sexual assault as well, but don't worry, I'll tell you right beforehand, so I got you. And starting with Kaylee, the victim in our story. Kaylee Ann Sawyer, sometimes called KK, was born on March 2nd of 1993 in Bend, Oregon, to Julie and Jamie Sawyer. And though they would later divorce, they both actually ended up happily remarrying and ending with Kaylee being the oldest of 5, having 4 little brothers between each side of her very large family. She was said to love skiing and snowboarding, which Oregon State is the perfect place to live for that because you can drive in almost any direction and find awesome runs. As a young adult, Kaylee wanted to become a dentist and was actually working as a dental assistant at the local dentist's office known as Aubrey Dental. Kaylee had been living with her boyfriend for the last 2 years. His name is Cameron. And they lived together in an apartment located near the Central Oregon Community College, where she had attended. Kaylee was really just at the very beginning of what I'm sure was going to be a very long and beautiful life. But as we all know, there's just some really shitty people out there, even in the safest of places. So it all begins on what was actually a Saturday night when Kaylee would first go out and celebrate with one of her close friends' bachelorette parties to begin around 9 p.m. She and her girlfriends went into downtown Bend, Oregon to have some fun. Of course, they'd spend the night flirting, drinking, and dancing. That's pretty much what bachelorette parties are, basically. At about midnight, Kaylee's boyfriend, Cameron, gets the call that she's ready to come home as he is her designated driver. And we always stand a responsible boyfriend, you guys. So Cameron heads down to the bar and picks her up. She enters Cameron's car and they head back to their apartment together. While on the way back home, though, Kaylee and her boyfriend Cameron started arguing about some guy that she might have been dancing with. And you know how it is when you're hot, young, and in love, and I'm guessing it wasn't their first fight. As they pull into their parking spot, they're still fighting, they both get out of the car, but Cameron walks upstairs to their apartment while Kaylee actually storms off the other way and starts walking through the parking lot in anger, trying to blow off some steam. We've all freaking been there, but remember now, she's dressed up from being downtown, she's drunk, and she's frustrated. So she's distracted is what I'm pointing out. It's probably about 12:30 on Sunday morning now, and Cameron gives Kaylee a few minutes to cool off, but she still hasn't come up to the apartment, so he calls her, asking her to just please come home. She's still heated, I guess, so they continue to argue for a bit, but now it's actually about where she's walking so that he can come get her again. And by this time, she's actually walking on one of the main roads of campus called College Way. She actually ended up hanging up on him as he was going back down to his car. So he sends a few texts pleading for her to stop walking. He calls again and says he's now driving around on the streets, but he can't find her anywhere. And naturally, this was right about as she complained that her cell phone is about to die and the cell phone cuts out. But like a good boyfriend, Cameron is here and he continues driving around for a little until he heads back home and waits for her to show up or call. And truthfully, he could probably care less about what even started the whole fight to begin with. Later that Sunday morning, when Cameron finally wakes up and Kaylee is still not shown back up at their apartment and her phone is still going to voicemail, he starts making calls to her friends and he heads to where Kaylee's car was parked to see if she had walked there. When none of her friends had seen her and her car was untouched, Cameron started making calls to Kaylee's family, hoping that she just needed the space and went somewhere safe. Cameron first calls Kaylee's mom, Julie, though she was actually out of cell phone reception range because she had gone camping that weekend. so she wasn't answering. So Cameron then calls Kaylee's dad, Jamie, who happened to be leaving church with his wife, and confirmed that he also had not talked to Kaylee. Lastly, though, Cameron even checked at the grandparents' house because Kaylee and them were very close, and still no sign of her. After a few hours of searching goes by, and finally Kaylee's mom, Julie, starts getting all the messages from Cameron, and she calls him back. Since she also has not spoken with Kaylee either, her mom is spooked and starts to tell Cameron that he needs to call the police at this point, since literally no one else has seen her since last night.
Dispatch, how can I help you? Hello?
Hi. I'm not sure if this is quite the right number to call. Last night I got home from the bars with my girlfriend, and she got upset at me and ran off. Mm-hmm. And I chased her and wasn't able to find her, and I still haven't heard from her. Her phone's off. I called all her family, and they haven't heard from her, so I'm wondering what you recommend I do.
We can put in a call, and we can have officers or deputies look for her.
Okay.
And where was she last seen at?
College Way.
College in what?
Alpine Meadows apartment complex. It's like at the top of College Way.
In that apartment complex?
Yes.
In a specific apartment, or?
In the parking lot.
Just in the parking lot? You guys don't live there, or?
Yes, we live there together.
Okay, what's the address? And this is her address as well, the Aubrey Pines?
Yes.
Okay. And it was last night?
Yeah.
About what time?
It was like 1 o'clock in the morning.
Okay. Take up walking or something from this address? Like, she was mad?
Yeah, I walked. She was mad at me, so I walked inside and told her to come meet me, and then when she's like, calm down. And then I went back out in 10 minutes, and she was gone. And I called her a few times, and she said she was walking down the street. And then I guess she said her phone is about to die, and then I couldn't get a hold of her after that. I haven't heard from her since.
By Sunday evening, when Kaylee didn't show up anywhere to shower, eat, or even charge her phone, Kaylee's mom would also decide to call 911 herself, while driving over to Kaylee and Cameron's apartment to get a better understanding of the situation straight from Cameron, because she was already suspicious that something bad had happened. With Kaylee's mom calling and telling the police that she's also epileptic and might need medication, Kaylee's then officially logged into the local missing persons database about 7:30 p.m. that evening. And her family and friends really begin their search efforts pretty quickly, but the police are really hoping that Kaylee's just super pissed and probably hiding out somewhere. So they will officially begin the search efforts the following morning if Kaylee doesn't show up for work that Monday the 25th. And really, with not much else to go off of, police initially have to double-check Kaylee's boyfriend's story, as he was technically the last person to see her alive. But even police detectives described him as 100% cooperative, and it was almost painfully obvious that he was innocent and just truly scared for her well-being. One of the most terrible things is never having the chance to amend stuff before someone is taken out of your life, and I can't imagine how painful of an experience this could be for this guy. It's important to keep in mind that you never really know the last time you're going to be seeing someone, so you make sure you take as many opportunities as you can to tell your people how much you love them. So after the boyfriend Cameron is officially cleared of involvement, police actually move on quickly to their next best lead. And impressively, the police officers even managed to track down some guy that Kaylee's friends remember her dancing with while out partying that Saturday night. But even that guy was able to corroborate that he had seen her leave the bar with her boyfriend. So yet again, no more leads, and it's still totally possible that Kaylee left on her own accord, as she is 23 years old, and she's free to leave if she wants to. So since police really have nothing, they start trying to locate her cell phone for any sort of direction that will move this forward. They don't really have to wait long though, because at about noon on Monday morning, just a few hours into the initial search, another officer on the police force in Bend would come in with a huge chunk of this puzzle already solved, and she was not very happy about it at all. So here comes the plot twist. This brand spanking new Bend police officer named Isabel comes in that same Monday morning, saying that she actually has some information on the girl that was reported missing over the weekend, and basically that she needs to speak to someone pretty high up. She's visibly upset, and while she explains to these detectives that are working on the case, and while she explains to detectives on the case that her own husband, Edwin, had just told her that he was the one who was responsible for killing the missing girl, but he had accidentally hit her with his work car. So Isabel's husband, Edwin Enoch Lara, is a 31-year-old part-time public safety officer at the Central Oregon Community College. He's originally from Honduras, but Edwin moved up to Los Angeles, California for a few years as a young child and then moved again up to Madras, Oregon, where he settled. And though he dropped out of high school, he did manage to get his GED and actually started working at the criminal justice program at Central Oregon Community College. So while he's actually in school, he's also working on campus as a security guard there for the school. And here's your trigger warning, because I'm about to cover what actually happened after Kaylee walked away from her apartment and why she hasn't come home yet. Edwin Lara, who was driving around campus at the end of his shift and was apparently posting signs for some bike race that was to be held on campus the next day. This was when he drives by Kaylee, who's very pretty, she's blonde, she's dressed up, and she's probably crying walking down the sidewalk. Edwin pulls over and offers her a ride. It's even possible that he did hit her with a car, but for whatever reason, Kaylee ended up in the backseat of this patrol car, which actually had the barricade and cannot be opened from the inside of the backseat. So Edwin immediately demanded for Kaylee's purse and her cell phone, and that's when Kaylee realized that she was in a really bad situation and she started freaking out. She's screaming. So Edwin gets out of the front seat of the car, he enters the back seat of the car, and chokes Kaylee until she passes out. Edwin then drives with Kaylee's body in the back seat of the security car up to a more secluded parking lot in the back area of the campus known as Lot B12. When Edwin stops the car, he begins getting Kaylee out of the back when she wakes up, and she begins struggling to get away from him. And that's when this total piece of trash quickly grabs a nearby rock and hits Kaylee square in the head with it, ending the struggle abruptly. And believing that Kaylee is no longer alive, he rapes her body, because in his words, why not? Which is literally what he told the detectives later. But when he realized that she actually isn't dead yet, he then has to go and grab a bigger rock, and again, hits her in the head so that she'll stop fighting back. He then drags Kaylee's body a short distance away from Lot B12 to behind some nearby trees while he runs the patrol car back down to the office. He cleans it up and takes a shower himself, all before returning back to her body in his own personal car. Edwin then wrapped Kaylee's head in a plastic grocery bag to contain the blood coming from her two large head wounds and places her body in the trunk. This would have been around 1 to 2 a.m. early that Sunday morning of July 24th, and just as her boyfriend Cameron was probably driving around on College Way looking for her. Edwin then drives the body in his car back to his home over in Redmond, which is about a half hour away. Police indicated that they believe Edwin had dumped Kaylee somewhere before returning to his home, but they were never able to find that spot. When he gets there, he tosses all of Kaylee's belongings, her purse, her shoes, and even the rock he used to kill her with, all in the same white garbage bag, and shoves it into his backyard shed. I can't get over how someone who's basically a rent-a-cop and going to criminal justice school would think that a rock, aka the murder weapon, was something that he should grab and keep with all the victims' shit too. Like, was he trying to get caught? What a dumbass. So, it's probably about 3 a.m. now, and Edwin just casually crawls into bed with his wife Isabel like he didn't just murder and have sex with an innocent girl's body. Ugh. According to his wife Isabel, Edwin and her wake up later that Sunday morning and they attend church together at 9 a.m. in her Jeep, which is super fucking creepy now that we know exactly what this guy likes to do in his off time. But also, his wife said that she really didn't notice anything different about Edwin or his behavior except that he was a little bit more quiet than usual. After church, though, Isabel said that they grabbed some Pizza Hut and headed back home for some Netflix and chill. And while into that, Edwin randomly decides that he wants to go back out and see the new scary movie, Lights Out, with his cousin Vinny. And no, that's not a joke, his cousin's name is really Vinny. I believe Isabel joins them too for the 7:45 showing. After this movie, they walk around the mall for a little bit, they dropped off cousin Vinny back at his place, and Edwin and Isabella return home around midnight. So the next morning though, which is the Monday that police are waiting for Kaylee to hopefully show up at work, Isabel gets up at about 9 a.m. and Edwin stayed in bed. She said she went out and she watered the lawn, and while she was eating some breakfast, Edwin woke up and comes out of their bedroom visibly upset. So she begins asking him what his problem is, and that's when he just starts blubbering to her about how he killed a girl, but it was an accident. And quite obviously, when she wasn't like, oh my god, let me fix this for you because I am a cop, and just kept asking more questions that he really didn't want to have to answer or admit to, he freaks out and starts rambling about getting in a lot of trouble. Edwin then allegedly grabs Isabella's police-issued handgun, her handcuffs, and her bulletproof vest, and tells Isabel that Her stuff is in the garage. And then just straight up leaves the house and dips the fuck out. Now, since Isabel is really confused and what he's saying is not making sense to her, she goes back out and finds the bag of Kaylee's things in their shed. And that's when Isabel gets herself dressed and proceeds right down to the police station so that she can explain what she thinks just happened to her fellow officers. I mean, and honestly, that's a good woman. Good on her for not hiding out and keeping the secret. Or just straight up gone girling herself, because she totally could have, and I respect that. And while Isabel is talking to police, they ask her if Edwin's ever had any previous history of being violent, if he was at all into drugs or alcohol. And she had explained that he was never violent, and they'd stopped drinking when they started attending church together, which was pretty regularly at this point. But she also tells them that he's no saint either. She tells police that Edwin had recently come clean to her about an affair that he had been having while she was away training in the police academy, and that he seemed remorseful about it, and it might have just been something he was doing out of jealousy since she was accepted to the academy as an officer and he was not. She mentioned that she did, though, join him on several ride-alongs while patrolling at the community college. She lastly informed police that he was likely on his way to Southern California where he has grandparents, so they also start tracking the location of his cell phone, hoping that he hasn't gotten too far away already. They managed to get one ping near Eagle Crest, Oregon, which is about a half hour north of Bend, but then his battery apparently went dead, which cuts the signal to any additional towers. Overall, though, Isabel's pretty much just as confused as everyone else, maybe even more so. And police immediately issue and send out an alert or a bolo, be on the lookout for this Edwin Enoch Lara driving a silver Altima, possibly heading south towards California, and noting that he was armed and possibly dangerous. But unbeknownst to Isabel, when Edwin actually left their home that morning, he didn't just go straight to California. He actually drove over to his parents' house where he dropped off his car and proceeded to take theirs. Interestingly, though, Edwin had scribbled out some little note that he left in his Altima that reads 18700 three times in a row, and that's it. And remember in my last episode with Jody Arias when I brought up a 187 bit with Snoop Dogg? Because, yeah, there it is again. But obviously, at this point, Edwin is making a run for it and trying to distance himself between the murder and his own car, because obviously his wife has gone to the police, or at least he knew she would. And thank God she did, because honestly, this case could have gone on a lot longer than it already does. Edwin then drives his parents' car from Redmond to Salem, Oregon, which is about 2.5 hours away, and for some reason decides to then ditch his parents' car at one of the shopping malls in the area. Still on his mission, though, Edwin just posts up and waits, pretty much watching for someone that he can force into driving him farther out of the area. So literally any female or small male walking around Salem at that time was a prospective target for this fucking asshole. He'll later say that he did actually try to talk to this pregnant woman at the mall, but she wasn't having none of that and totally blew him off. But he sort of told it like, man, she was so lucky I didn't have the time to kill her or something like that. Sort of like he controlled the fact that she wasn't his victim, when it was more like that lady probably saw them psycho vibes from a mile away and just noped right the fuck out of there. Good for her. Guys, be like her. Be that bitch, be or that asshole. Don't fuck around and get dragged into other people's bullshit. Your gut instinct is very important, and if he seems like a creep, he probably is. But shortly after 9 a.m. that Monday, when Kaylee's family is already gearing up their flyers and their Facebook posts with pictures and a description of what Kaylee was last seen wearing, which was a black dress, black wedges, with a green purse, and she has long blonde hair. And her stepmom had even gotten the help of a family friend in an organization called the Destiny Search Project to get involved in spreading the news that Kaylee was missing. And it was a major scale effort from that point on. It was reported that about 200 volunteers had arrived to help search for her, and even a GoFundMe page was created proactively to raise funds to increase the search efforts right off the bat. This is exactly the type of effort I would expect to see in a family not involved in the missing person's disappearance. It's where I like to use the phrase WWJWD, or what would John Walsh do? It's something to keep in mind when we're talking about missing persons cases that continue going unsolved, but the detectives working this case would end up having to tell her family, based on what they've heard from Isabel over at the Bend station, that it really had just gone from a missing persons case to a homicide case. And like I said in the beginning, I legit remember seeing and sharing this girl's missing poster on my personal Facebook feed because, given the circumstances, she could have easily driven to my town that's within just a few hours away. So now, researching this case 3 years later, I have this weird moment when I was able to put the name to the face and realize that she didn't just go missing, she was selfishly murdered. And I'll describe it in this way, but Kaylee is abso-frickin-lutely gorgeous. She has this memorable type of beauty about her. So looking back at the time when I saw her missing poster that was being shared throughout the Pacific Northwest, little did we know that it was really already too late to save her. By that Monday night, Edwin is posted up somewhere in the parking lot right outside of a Ross Dress for Less clothing store within a strip mall not far from where he ditched his parents' car in Salem, Oregon. So he's on the lookout for someone he can get to drive him to Southern California where he has some extended family. 19-year-old Andrea Mays had just worked a double shift at the Ross clothing store, and at 8:45 p.m., this lunatic Edwin just happens to watch Andrea walk to her little golden Volvo 850, where she sits down and checks her phone, taking a second to relax after her long-ass double shift in retail customer service. Yuck. Ladies, also don't fucking do this shit, because someone like Edwin, Lara, might be waiting for someone like you to just be in the wrong place at the wrong time and catch you off guard. That's exactly what happened here. Just as Andrea goes to check her messages after this long day, a psycho is opening up her car door and shoving a gun in her face while shouting to drive the fucking car. So she's like, yeah, sure, whatever, dude, just, you know, don't shoot me in the face, okay? And she explains in interviews that she just froze and she really thought that he meant he just wanted to ride up the road, and also that if she listened, he wouldn't hurt her. So she's like, okay, yeah, sure, where are we going? And then he tells her Southern California, and she basically shits her pants because they're in Central Oregon, and that's like hours away from them. So really, she's about to take her third fucking shift for the night and is super pissed, I bet, that she didn't tell whoever didn't want to come into work that day to fuck off, because now some guy with a gun is forcing her to drive across two states. They end up driving for a couple hours on the I-5 South, but while doing so, Edwin decides to break the ice and try to make small talk with Andrea. He starts by telling her that he's wanted for murder, which is a great choice, Edwin. He then tells her his whole life story and how he's a cop, even though it's his wife who's a real cop, while he's just a rent-a-cop, really. But most disturbingly, he especially wants to talk about how he's always had this urge to kill, which of course I'm sure makes Andrea contemplate just driving the car off the road. She does say that she's heard of doing that in situations like this, but she didn't want to die, and she really thought she might be able to just get him where he wanted to go, and she could just, you know, turn around and go home and go to sleep. She said he also was letting her stop and use the side of the road to pee whenever she needed to, so she still felt like she had a little bit of control. 3 hours into their trip to Cali, Edwin and Andrea are next seen on video surveillance, actually, checking into the Relax Inn located in Cottage Grove, Oregon. This was just before midnight on that Monday morning, and police have no idea that he's been traveling with Andrea at this point. You can quite clearly see in some of these angles of the videotapes which have been released, which I will add to the YouTube channel and the episode source if you guys need the visual aids to help with these cases, but Andrea is clearly not enjoying herself and explains to interviewers that she was super frustrated that this attendant of the motel didn't clue into the fact that she was so much younger than Edwin, and that she'd clearly been crying. I mean, even her posture in the video, her arms are crossed and closed in, and she's obviously scared, and I wish someone would have given a shit, honestly. I feel freaking terrible for what this girl ends up going through. When they get into the hotel room, Edwin decides that he wants to take a shower. But he's also worried that Andrea will run, so he, no joke, handcuffs her to the bathroom doorknob so she can't run off and snitch. He also proceeds to wrap a towel, or a shirt actually, I think it was, around her head before he gets into the shower so she wouldn't have to see his twat. But honestly, she wasn't gonna look anyways, because why would she? This guy's done nothing but inconvenience her. I have no idea what would give him the idea she's even remotely interested in him or what he's packing. After he showers, he then tells her that she needs to take a shower. And I love that she was like, no, thanks, I don't have any other clothes, and hey man, I like never asked to be kidnapped. Which I guess he didn't argue with, so good for her, honestly. But then, Edwin pulls out these bottles of random pills from his backpack and tells Andrea that if she doesn't take these pills, as he says, he's gonna inject her with some of them using the syringes he also pulled out of the backpack. Now it's like some saw shit going on. I believe both of these items came from his parents' home, where he stopped by and basically stole their car for his whole trip he's got going. But now Andrea is literally handcuffed to this ratty-ass motel bed, and she's being forced to take some pills that I'm not even sure if she knew were actually going to be sleeping pills. I mean, it could have been acid or anything, really. After being forced to take these sleeping pills, Andrea says they're laying on this nasty bed together. And remember, it's not by choice, so she's fucking handcuffed to it. And she's trying super duper hard not to fall asleep, even though she's honestly hella tired because, you know, two shifts in retail and a road trip with a psycho is probably going to do a number on your energy levels, right? So she's fighting this sleep as Edwin starts kissing her on the earlobe and down her neck. But suddenly, by the power of fucking Jesus, Andrea's phone alarm starts going off, which triggers Edwin because he's afraid now that she's working with the police somehow. Like, he kidnapped her. How could that even happen? But luckily, though, Andrea is just lucid enough to make up a story about this terribly contagious, disgusting STD she has, and that the alarm is just for her medication. And apparently this just completely turns him off and away from her, which is like, yes, girl, two birds, one stone. And she's very creatively just saved herself from being raped by some creep. Snaps, girl, snaps. Edwin seemed to be pretty spooked, though, at this point, and either makes a phone call or receives one, but either way, he's speaking in Spanish to someone on the other line, according to Andrea. Andrea is, like, eavesdropping on this conversation, and she can understand a little Spanish, so she can apparently gather that Edwin believes the police are onto him and currently searching for him so that he needs to keep moving to wherever he plans to end up. So not even 5 hours after they checked in, Edwin and Andrea are back on the fucking highway to hell, heading closer to the California border. And that's when Andrea's car starts having some issues. At this time, Edwin decides that they will need to stop and get a new ride somehow. So yet again, Edwin is fishing for someone that he can easily victimize so he can continue on down the road. It's now bright and early on Tuesday, July 26th, and on the ground level of a Super 8 motel in Yreka, California, a 73-year-old butterfly photographer named Jack is loading his photography equipment into his car for a trip he's about to make out to the mountains. And he's really just in the wrong place at the wrong time, and Edwin drags Andrea into this old dude's room where he proceeds to demand the old man's car keys. Jack himself said that they sort of caught him off guard, and for like a split second there, he just assumed that they walked into the wrong room. But when he didn't give Ed the keys immediately, Ed pulled out a gun and shot Jack square in the stomach area. Andrea, who was behind Ed when this happened, suddenly, like, wakes the fuck up when Ed tells her to run, and she for some reason follows, and they run across the parking lot over to a gas station. Thankfully, Jack is able to call the front desk of the motel, who then calls the police, and he's taken over to the Rogue Valley Medical Center, where his condition's brought back to stable, and he actually ended up making a full recovery. Over at the gas station, though, there just so happens to be this minivan sitting near the pumps where half the occupants are actually inside the mini mart and the other half are waiting in this van. And Edwin runs up on a teenager sitting in the driver's seat and forces himself and Andrea into the car. This teen's father and grandfather were actually inside the store, and he just happened to be waiting in the car with his elderly, non-English speaking grandmother and his little brother and their freaking dog. And before these kids can even get the attention of their father inside, Edwin hops in and goes, "You guys like Mexico?" No, I'm kidding. But he does kick the dog out and he does end up carjacking these people. So as they start driving down the road yet again, Edwin takes this opportunity to tell the two boys and their very, very confused grandma about how he's wanted for murder, he's always had this urge to kill, and that he's on the run to California. After hearing Edwin's whole, like, life story, the teenager in the front seat takes his cue to inform Edwin that he's actually kidnapped them during their foreign grandmother's first trip to America and that she's probably never going to come back again now, which I think actually struck a chord with Edwin or something, because he then has this kid pull over to the side of the road near a rest stop just outside of Weed, California, and Edwin only lets the two boys and their grandmother out but plans to keep their car. So Andrea takes a second and is like, "Dude, just take the car and leave me too. What the fuck?" And he's like, "Girl, I need you for a human shield, so you're sane." And so once again, Edwin and Andrea are on the road again. Within an hour of driving, though, Edwin then instructs Andrea to take a live stream from her phone. He told her to title it "Murder on the Loose" and proceeds to film himself acting a damn fool.
"Hi, everybody. I just want to say that I apologize for everything I've done. Most likely I'm going to get caught, and sorry about that girl in Central Oregon, and I just want to let family members, Andrea, that she's fine, and she will be fine, because so far she's been doing what I've been calling her to, you know, and if you guys are wondering, if I have done dirty things to her, no. All right, I'm not that kind of guy. You know, I just killed that other girl, you know, and I regret it. I regret killing her. You know, she's kept screaming and I'm sorry for her forever. So, you know, like I say, she's still fine. We're driving and she'll be home pretty soon. I'm sorry to her grandma and her family members, to her boyfriend. You know, I'm sorry. I think that I caused. Okay, and you'll see her pretty soon. Okay, tell the cops that not to shoot us, because if they shoot us, then that's not my fault. Okay, but sorry, everybody.
Andrea is one smart cookie, though, because as much as this might have actually helped her be found sooner, she didn't want people seeing the post, so she actually changed the privacy settings really quickly before posting it so that she was the only one who could see it. It was eventually released, though, obviously. After this super obnoxious Facebook video, Edwin then oddly decides to call the police on himself at about 6:40 a.m. on that Tuesday morning. While he's on the phone, he's driving super fast. He says it's because he wants to turn himself in faster. And that's when he's noticed by a California State Highway Patrol woman, and a small chase ensues, with Edwin continuing to drive between 80 and 120 miles per hour while on the phone.
Tuesday, 7/26/2016 at 0640.
190 emergency reporting.
Yes, hi. This is Edwin Lara. And I'm the guy on Interstate 5, going at high speed. I know you guys have the chopper on me already.
Yeah.
And, I just want to say I am going to turn myself in.
Okay, where are you at?
Okay, I'm on I-5. I think close to Redding, if I'm right. So, you know, I am wanted for murder in the state of Oregon.
Okay. Edwin, yeah. Where are you at right now? Can you stop?
I am going to stop once I hit Redding. Once I'm in Redding, I'm going to stop.
Okay, can you tell me where you are right now?
I have no idea.
Okay.
Let's see. There's a sign right here. 50 miles from Redding.
You're 50 miles from Redding. Can you see a mile mark or anything?
From Corning.
You're 50 miles from Corning.
Yeah, 50 miles from Corning. 50 miles south or north of Corning.
Are you by yourself or?
No, I have someone with me. I kidnapped her in Oregon. She is innocent. Her name is Andrea. What's your last name?
He doesn't know.
I'll let her give her last name so you can call her family, okay?
Okay.
Just give me a second.
What's your name?
Hello?
Yeah, hi. What's your name?
Andrea.
Okay, are you hurt at all, Andrea?
No.
No? Okay. Do you know where you are? Let me talk to Edwin again.
Okay.
Hello?
Yeah, Edwin. You're heading southbound on 5?
Yeah, I'm heading southbound on 5. I'm 50 miles away.
Okay, I'm sorry. Did you make it past Redding yet?
I think I did. I'm 50 miles from Corning.
You're 50 miles from Corning?
Yeah, 1-5, 15.
Oh, 15 miles from Corning.
Yes. So I'm passing a state trooper, a highway patrol right now.
You're what, sir?
I'm passing a highway patrol.
Okay, where are you at, though?
I am Flores Avenue, 1 mile from Flores Avenue.
1 mile from Flores? Are you able
yes.
to safely find somewhere to stop?
I'm not going to stop right here. I'm just going to turn myself in and Corning. Okay.
Are you going to Corning Police, or where are you going?
Yeah, I'm going to Corning Police. But I want to ask you a favor.
Uh-huh.
So I have asthma.
You have asthma? Okay.
Yeah, so you tell them not to be too rough on me because, you know, I can barely breathe right now. All right, so that's all I wanted to say.
Do
you know, I don't want to.
Any kind of medical or?
Yeah, well, I think so. I'm going to need my inhaler. I forgot my inhaler at home. You know, I went all over Salem, Oregon looking for an inhaler, but I guess they don't sell it, you know, behind the counter or out of counter. So,
Edwin, how fast are you going?
I'm going about 120 miles an hour
right now. 120 miles an hour?
Yes.
Can you slow down?
Well, I want to make it there quick. That way I can turn myself in.
Well, the officer sees you. That we just don't want you to speed away from anything. If you can stop and just give yourself in, it'll probably be easier.
Well, there's an officer behind me right now.
Okay, they see you. We're talking to him. They see you.
Yeah, she's seeing me. I think it's a she. She's right behind me.
Okay. The officer sees you. And are you able to safely stop?
Yeah, I can stop, but not right now. I'll stop in Corning.
What's the difference from stopping now in Corning?
I just don't want to stop right here in the middle of the road, you know, putting myself in danger and putting everybody else in danger, more in danger, I guess.
You know, they won't. They're aware. I'll let them know they won't. But if you can stop safely, they just don't want you to run. They think you're trying to run or anything.
Okay.
After driving through three different counties in California and just before 7 a.m., Edwin is then arrested without incident by that highway patrol woman on the side of Interstate 5 South, just outside of Corning, California. Regardless of him mentioning he was wanted for murder, he was additionally charged with the suspicion of an assault with a firearm, but really it's an attempted murder, also a carjacking, criminal threats, and kidnapping, and he was taken and held at the Tehama County Jail without the option of bail. Get this, though. Police initially believe that it's possible that Andrea was actually an accomplice to Edwin in some way, likely from the perspective given by Jack when he was shot in the stomach at the hotel room. And as fucked up as it sounds, police would be stupid to not treat her as a possible accomplice given the circumstances, but obviously the entire process of being arrested and photographed for a mugshot would absolutely add insult to injury after she was in reality just terrorized by this fucking psycho for the last 19 hours of her life. And now she's being asked to spread them cheeks because the cops can't tell if she's lying or not. I mean, no matter what, it's a really shitty situation for Andrea, and it's almost unbelievable what happened to her. If that was me, best believe you would be finding me trying to flip off the camera during the mugshot so that I could turn it into a poster for my house when the cops eventually figure out that they're wrong. Anyway, detectives from Bend, Oregon then come down to Tehama County to first question Edwin only about the whereabouts of Kaylee. They basically sit down and it's literally the first thing out of the detective's mouth. And at first, Edwin doesn't want to tell detectives where he put her body until he gets back home, which these detectives are like, no, that's not how this is going to work. And they start pulling the religious card because one of these detectives was actually a former minister or something of that nature and is totally aware of how religious Edwin actually is. So this detective actually starts bringing up the old Bible story of Cain and Abel, and not too long into that conversation, Edwin's asking for a piece of paper and a pen so that he can make a map for police to recover her body, while eventually spilling the beans about what really happened to her, but not before trying to sugarcoat it like a million times. Detectives on the ground back in Oregon were quickly able to drive out to the area where Edwin is talking about, and Kaylee's body was then located in the early afternoon hours in a small canyon off Highway 126, just 10 miles away from Redmond. She was about 20 feet from the highway road, laying at the bottom of a hill where the road there turns around a rock cliff, and it's really a spot that not many people would be stopping to look there. I'm sure tons of people passed it, honestly, without even thinking about it. So police are still actively talking with Edwin as police in Oregon are recovering her body, and Edwin is basically saying at first that it was all just an accident when he hit her. Then it was an accident that just got out of hand. Then as he keeps spinning his version, police are consistently poking holes in his case, asking questions like, well, why did you take her phone then? And he's like, because I didn't want her to call the cops. And then they're slowly but surely, these detectives are forcing Edwin casually to have to explain all these other circumstances that aren't matching to his story. For example, why is his semen found on her body? And how the hell that could happen with a civil car accident? After being confronted with pretty much all the facts of the case, he finally admits that he actually thought she was a hooker and offered her a ride, and when she became offended and started screaming because she was afraid, that's when he panicked and strangled her. When that didn't work and he tried to rape her, he had to kill her. The next day, the medical examiner performed the autopsy and found that Kaylee's cause of death was blunt force trauma, and her family was actually advised not to do the usual last viewing because of the level of damage done to her body. So her family was literally forced to just accept that their baby girl was not going to return home. Police also searched Edwin and Isabel's home, where inside the same shed that Edwin stored the rock and Kaylee's belongings, they also came across an old school project that Edwin had apparently done on the serial killer Angel Resendez, otherwise known as the Railway Killer, who had at least 16 victims throughout the entire southern United States. The police obviously found this super creepy, but he was a student at the time, and I mean, I also do presentations on serial killers, but then again, you're listening to me do it, and we both know we're not fucking killers, okay? But still, he apparently saved this project hidden away in the shed, so it apparently wasn't worthy of being put on the fridge like I do when my kids make something cool. He seems to be, like, shamefully proud of it, I guess. But while Edwin is waiting for his extradition back to Oregon, he actually has the nerve to make a phone call to his wife, Isabella, where he informs her that his rights are being violated and that they won't let him speak to a lawyer. And he's sort of, like, begging her to get him some help.
Well, here, trying to put my life back together.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that. Okay.
So when is your court? When are you having court?
So right now I feel that all my rights are being violated. Because an attorney hasn't been appointed to me, although, you know, they read my rights when I got here. They're like...
¿No has hablado o no has hablado?
Yeah, I keep asking for an attorney, and there is no attorney, because...
Okay, so...
For me to be transferred to Oregon, and that's going to take a while. So,
okay, mira, yo, okay.
All I want is a lawyer. That's all I want. I want a freaking lawyer because my rights are being violated right now. And a lawyer was supposed to be appointed to me from the moment I have a lawyer. And a lawyer was supposed to be appointed to me from the moment I asked for a lawyer. And I've been asking for lawyers since I got basically booked yesterday or whenever that was, 2 days ago. I don't know what day it is today. I don't even know what time it is. I love you.
So just solo. Okay, I'm doing what I could do for you.
Just get me that freaking lawyer. That's all I need.
Yes, yes.
The news are gonna get here Sunday, so they're gonna talk to me on Sunday. You know.
Talk to who?
The news, News Channel 21.
Talk to you?
Yeah, they want to talk to me. So.
So entonces estoy en eso, lo que estoy en eso y estoy hablando con sus papás, okay? Okay, so it's getting done.
All right, just get me the lawyer. I just need a lawyer. That's it.
Yes, very
now, cool. Right now, I'm being possibly in prison. You know, at this time. You know, I'm not even know why I'm being booked for. Right? You know, they haven't told me these are your charges or anything like that. You know, that's all I want. I just want a lawyer. Just give me that lawyer.
Hey, babe, I know you're eventually going to find out that I actually raped and killed this girl and it wasn't an accident at all, but, like, seriously, can you please for once just focus on me and my needs and just respect my right to a lawyer? Psh, he's legit like, hey, babe, how's it going? She's like, are you fucking kidding me, Edwin? I don't know, just trying to put my life back together. What about you, though? I'd be like, new phone, who fucking this? Get out of here, block. By Friday, Edwin actually has the fucking nerve to also walk into court and plead not guilty after his whole ass confession, not only to police, but Facebook Live and all the other people he kidnapped. So clearly, I think he was able to talk to a lawyer at some point. He's eventually extradited back up to Oregon by the end of July. And 2 months after that, Edwin was officially indicted by the federal grand jury for the carjacking, the kidnappings, and the attempted murder that occurred down in California. The Deschutes County District Attorney in Oregon has also decided that they would be pursuing the death penalty for the charges in Ed's crimes against Kaylee. So basically, the state of Oregon wants him dead, and the federal government wants a piece of him too. Edwin's wife, Isabel, who's no doubt very embarrassed and wants nothing to do with him, actually files for divorce almost immediately after the news of Kaylee's murder went public. She's also placed on paid leave shortly after the incident so that she could have some time to get her life back together, while remaining a strong resource within the investigation as well. But then the entire case against Edwin is jeopardized because, as it turns out, there is a California state statute that gives everyone the right to a total of 3 telephone calls within the first 3 hours of being arrested for a crime. And apparently, Edwin did not get to make these calls, and because of this, his entire confession he subsequently made to Oregon detectives was going to have to be tossed out as evidence that he murdered Kaylee, regardless of everything he had already admitted to. He quite literally fell into the luckiest legal loophole here. But the case wasn't a total bust. They still had a lot of evidence that Edwin ironically gathered up for them and put into this one garbage bag in the shed. So in preparation for his upcoming trial, his defense had requested to relocate Edwin's trial from Bend because of the excessive media coverage. He was actually denied, and his trial was then scheduled to start sometime in October. But before then, in July, while waiting for the trial to begin, Kaylee's family would actually attempt to hold the Central Oregon Community College responsible for the ease at which Edwin was able to victimize Kaylee. The reason that the school had given their public safety department access to caged vehicles, handcuffs, and uniforms that appear very similar to city police officers, which enabled Edwin to appear as a person of trust. And really, though, I don't think the college could have ever seen this coming, considering on paper, Edwin really didn't have much of a rap sheet. So it's very possible that even with the most thorough of background checks, someone with a so-called urge to kill, but no prior history of it, would actually be pretty hard to spot by itself. The college would end up being in a pretty tough spot, though, after an internal investigation found additional instances of, quote, legal overreach within their security permit. So the lawsuit would take a bit of time to figure out. Out of nowhere, though, before the trial starts, Edwin was offered a plea agreement, which would reduce his charges from 4 counts to 2 if he would plead guilty to 1 count of aggravated robbery and 1 count of aggravated murder for the abduction and murder of 23-year-old Kaylee Sawyer, which he did actually agree to by January 2018. So now Edwin wouldn't have to risk getting the death penalty in a jury trial, and he could be sentenced right away in regards to her murder. At that time, Kaylee's dad spoke on the witness stand about how he was never able to see his daughter for the last time and how he was robbed of their last goodbye. And Kaylee's mom was really strong as hell when she rubbed it in Edwin's face that even though he wanted to silence Kaylee from screaming, he wasn't able to silence the community from coming together over her tragic and senseless loss. Her grandfather also expressed interest in being the one to give Edwin the punishment that he truly deserved, but ended it on a good rotten hell scumbag. By far the best impact statement, in my opinion, though, was an older family friend of hers named Doug, who I honestly think has just this beautiful way with words, and I'll let you listen because I couldn't do it justice if I tried.
You have no idea how much irreversible damage this piece of shit has done to my extended family. With that said, I'm not much of a religious person, but I have my beliefs, and one of them is an eye for an eye. So if you will give custody to this piece of shit, to my extended family, we'll take them out in the desert. We'll let the eagles, the hawks, the coyotes, and the maggots eat that piece of shit alive. And then, when the buzzards are done pecking his friggin' body, I'm going to shit in his face and piss on his carcass. And I'm going to fill his carcass full of lead.
If you don't ride for me like that, then I don't want you. During Edwin's turn to speak, he actually asked Kaylee's family to ask Kaylee to forgive him because, quote unquote, he knows God doesn't let the devil speak to angels. And being that he was raised religiously, this idea of forgiveness seems to mean a lot to this guy. He also prayed to God that he heal the broken hearts of the community, but I'm pretty sure no one in Kaylee's family cared to stay to hear what he had to say, because I sure as hell wouldn't. The judge presiding over the case ended the hearing by telling Edwin, "You were acting as the predator that you were that evening. You saw this vulnerable young woman as somebody you could prey upon. There is no doubt about that. You can sugarcoat it, but this is exactly what you did." The same judge then awarded Edwin with a life sentence behind bars without parole. And I feel underwhelmed with that after hearing all the emotion from her family members, honestly. Over in California, Ed would also be charged with a total of 5 felonies, one of which was the attempted murder of 73-year-old Jack. And in April 2019, Edwin again had to go back down to their court for these crimes, but this time it was a federal court because he had kidnapped someone and taken them across state lines, which is a big no-no, obviously. At this court hearing, Edwin was then awarded a second life sentence to be served concurrently with the life sentence for Kaylee's murder. A U.S. District Court judge actually went above and beyond the recommended penalty of just an additional 20 years, but this judge was literally like, "Fuck that noise, you deserve 5 times that shit, you're gonna die here." Okay, the judge didn't say all that, but I sure would have. His defense lawyer actually argued the fact, because it's his job, that a second life sentence was completely unnecessary because he's already going to be serving the rest of his life behind bars anyways, but also that he was recently evaluated and found to have some crazy form of genetic degenerative brain disorder or a disability or something or other that he apparently got from his mom. But basically that it's not his fault he thinks this destructive way, and it's basically wrong of us to categorize him as some psychopathic killer. Welp, I sort of call bullshit, but he's really just doing his job as a defense lawyer, honestly. Then Andrea got up there on the stand and was actually one of the only people to speak that got Edwin to look at her in the face while she was talking. She told him, "You thought you stole my life from me, but I'm not a victim. I'm a survivor, I'm a warrior, and I'm stronger than I've ever been, and you're gonna rot where you belong." And then it was his turn to make a statement, and Andrea and her family walked out before he had a chance to blubber some more about God and making things right. And some more good things would keep happening. That very same month that Edwin was handed his second life sentence, the state of Oregon had also just passed a new bill known as Cayley's Law, which pushes for overall security reform within both the police and the security forces in Oregon, and will hopefully prevent future instances of those in positions of power abusing that power like Edwin did. Changes to non-police security equipment like caged back seats have been taken away, car cameras have been added, and there will now be much more thorough background checks on those applying to security enforcement positions. Because newsflash, we sure seem to have a shit ton of rogue sociopaths interested in appearing trustworthy and gaining positions of power. The governor of Oregon was quoted in saying that Cayley's death was a tragedy and we want to make sure that this never happens to a promising young Oregonian again. And it's a great start, but it's hardly ever going to fill the void in Cayley's family. Upon further investigation by the FBI too, it turns out that there's actually a real possibility that Edwin might have killed once or twice before while back when he was visiting his home country of Honduras. Some of his coworkers, who describe Edwin as a quiet but focused coworker/student, had actually said that while Ed was on this trip back to Honduras just a year or so before Cayley's murder, that he would no joke send this little group of coworker friends he had picture messages of random ass dead bodies on the side of the road, or in the water, or wherever he was in Honduras at the time. But the friends were like, yeah, he was just sort of weird like that, and most of them just deleted the pictures and didn't even reply back. But when he gets back home to Oregon, I guess he also showed them some videos of him and his girlfriend having sex unbeknownst to her, and this was back when he was cheating on his wife. So obviously, he's just a total scumbag all around from what I can tell. The FBI did actually look further back into Ed's background, all the way back to his family in Honduras, and have not found enough proof that he killed anyone else, though the detectives who worked on Cayley Sawyer's case believe Edwin Lara was most definitely capable of killing before and especially after, so that's why it was much, much more important to them that he literally spend the last of his days behind bars. And from what I understand, it seems as though this sort of darkness might just run in Edwin's family, or perhaps this was a contributing factor to Ed's mental issues, but one of the detectives working on the case, even before the arrest, actually recognized the family name Lara from another case that they had worked on about 4 years before. It turns out Edwin's stepfather actually was a preacher at one of the local churches in the Redmond area, and he was allegedly investigated for accusations of sexual abuse with minors. He was actually arrested, but was able to post bail and successfully jump town, so a warrant was issued for his arrest last year in 2019 and is still currently active. He goes by the name Jose Santos Flores Cardenas, but why on the earth would you not change your name if you were on the run, and I'm not sure how helpful telling you his name is, but that's all I got. The Redmond PD would like to know if that's something you could actually help out with. Edwin's cousin Vinny, too, who came and saw the so-called movie with Edwin and his wife that Sunday evening, might also possibly be partly involved in the moving of Cayley's body to its final location where police had discovered it. With part of Edwin's confession, it's believed that before returning home in the early morning hours after Cayley's death, Edwin had actually called his cousin to help him move her body, but only after he threatened to rat him out to immigration if he didn't help. Unfortunately for detectives, this cousin Vinny also skipped town before police could talk to them, and they're still looking. So his name is Melvin Rosalio Perez Vejia, and if there's a chance you know this Melvin or cousin Vinny, just let the Redmond Police Department know. Lastly, one of the better things I found was that just a couple months back this year in 2020, Cayley's family was actually awarded a reported $2 million settlement with the Central Oregon Community College from the lawsuit, as seeing how Edwin was actually on duty at the time of the murder. And even $200 million wouldn't fill a hole in your heart like the one Edwin left in her family's, but COCC did extend their apologies to the Sawyer family and also said, quote, "This is a heartbreaking and devastating crime. The individual responsible for this despicable act is rightfully in prison, but COCC is committed to ensuring that such a crime never happens again. The safety and well-being of our students, employees, and community are paramount to the college. On a side note to that, I learned that there's actually a limit to the amount that someone could be paid out when involved in a government-owned or public area lawsuit like this, and the school agreed to pay her family $2 million, which was actually more than they would have gotten if they went to a trial based on this cap on liability payouts. So the school was actually being very nice in that case, and that's a horrible way of putting it, but what I'm trying to say is that Kaylee's family could have actually been paid much, much, much less and just have had to deal with it. But it was the school that recognized the degree of loss here in the situation, which was pretty cool on their part and very rare, I feel like, too. If you guys are at all interested in hearing some of the perspectives of the actual detectives who worked on the case, check out the podcast series called Urge to Kill by KGW. It was the local news station in Oregon, and it covered Kaylee's entire story as well. It was like 5 or 6 episodes and really well done. I absolutely recommend it. Also, I have a poll up on the Patreon page for some upcoming cases that everyone can vote for, patron or not, as well as one for patrons about next month's bonus episode. So please slide over to patreon.com/gingerthetruecrimequeen if you care to submit your vote anyways. We're going to be slipping into spooky season 2, so my next few cases will be on the creepier side of true crime, actually. Lastly, I got a lot of love over the last 2 weeks. I'm super excited to shout out these names, honestly. Over on the Apple reviews, we got Ash Carlu, Zanla86, Tracy Lee, G Sharif, and Dive Forever. Thanks to all of you guys for the 5-star reviews. I really appreciate the time everyone takes to write their thoughts about the podcast. Seriously, I do appreciate the input very much. And then some of the most awesome people alive, aka the newest patrons of the podcast, are Rebecca, Becky, Z, Rudy S, Jennifer T, Melinda K, Vanessa K, and Florencia V, which I love the name Florencia. That is a dope ass name. Quite literally, the biggest thanks to you guys for your support. It is so nice to be validated for all this hard work. It's not going unnoticed. Seriously, thank you guys. As always, my loves, remember to lock those damn doors, including your car doors, especially the girls. You know who you are, who sit in the car and look at your phone. Stop doing that. For the love of God, I don't want to have to tell your story, okay? The tea. I hope you enjoyed my rendition of the story, and if so, please tell all your creepy ass friends about it, you guys. You can find the sources I used for the episode in its description. You can find me slanging those memes on Instagram at True Crime Queen. Check them out if you need some laughs after all the dark shit. If you'd like to support the podcast, check out patreon.com/gingerthetruecrimequeen. Alright, you guys, stay safe. Bye.